content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 21st, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week is a gas station scene. President Joe Biden has pulled up to the pump in a older model convertible Corvette. He's in a casual shirt and his usual aviator sunglasses. He's got his hand on his head and looks discouraged. Getting ready to fill up his tank is the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He may be the king now. He's smiling. He's got the pump in his hand, and you can see the high prices of gas on the sign back behind him. The headline is Gas Pains. How will Biden respond to the Saudis' decision to cut oil supplies? That's going to be our second main story, but we'll start with the first one. Putin's vengeance for Crimean bridge explosion. What happened? A barrage of missile strikes pounded civilian areas in Kyiv and at least 10 other cities across Ukraine this week, ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin in retaliation for an attack that damaged a strategically key bridge linking Russia to the Crimean Peninsula. Ukrainian authorities said at least 20 people were killed and 108 wounded in the initial round of strikes, which had panicked citizens diving for cover during morning rush hour. In Kyiv, Russian missiles and drones struck apartment buildings, an office tower, a pedestrian bridge, and a playground. Power and water were knocked out in numerous cities, including Lviv and Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials condemned the targeting of civilian areas, which follows weeks in which resurgent Ukrainian forces have reclaimed large swaths of territory in the south and east. "Your attacks provoke only rage and contempt in us," said Oleksiy Danilov, head of the National Security Council. "Not fear, not desire to negotiate." The revenge attacks came days after a massive explosion severely damaged the Kerch Strait Bridge, a 12-mile span that is vital conduit for bringing arms and supplies to Russian troops in southern Ukraine. Completed in 2018, the bridge is a source of deep pride for Putin, so the bomb blast, which Russia blamed on a truck bomb, was seen in Russia as both a military and symbolic disaster. A single lane on the bridge was reopened, but experts said it would take months to make the bridge fully operational. Ukraine did not claim credit, but the blast brought expressions of glee from Ukrainian officials and cries for retribution from Russian hawks. "It is time for fighting," tweeted senior Russian legislator Sergei Mironov, fiercely, even cruelly. President Biden, who warned last week that Putin might create a nuclear Armageddon, told CNN this week he believed the use of nuclear weapons was a line Putin wouldn't cross. "I think he is a rational actor who has miscalculated significantly," Biden said. In response to pleas from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, the White House promised to speed the delivery of two advanced missile defense systems, and Germany delivered the first of four promised systems. What the editorial said: Putin's bombardment of Ukrainian cities and civilians is a sign of desperation, said the Washington Post. Russian hardliners cheered the aerial terrorism, but are deceiving themselves if they think it will turn the tide. Russia faces defeat in the actual contest of armies, and the savage slaughter of civilians will only further stiffen Ukrainian resolve. Putin's targeting of civilians is the latest in the Kremlin's grim catalog of war crimes, said the Financial Times. It was also a militarily wasteful use of costly arms that are in short supply, especially since Ukraine claims to have intercepted more than half of the roughly 85 missiles fired. Russia's army is reportedly running low on munitions of all kinds, and sanctions on selling Moscow high-tech parts have made it difficult to make new ones. What the columnist said. The bridge attack hit Putin where it hurt, said Clara Ferreira Marquez in Bloomberg. The destruction of a feat of engineering that a proud Putin once called a miracle is a stunning embarrassment that underlines Russia's vulnerability. It comes at a perilous moment when Putin faces growing anger from both Russian hawks alarmed at his battlefield failures and citizens rattled by his chaotic mobilization of army reserves. Putin is now trapped, said Timothy Snyder in his Substack newsletter. Ukrainians have turned out to be stunningly good warriors, and Putin's decision to invade has become such a visible disaster that it threatens his rule. Using a tactical nuclear weapon on an extended battlefield hundreds of miles long would be of little military use, lead to the irradiation of Russian troops and of Russia itself, and create a blowback of international rage. Putin's only way to survive the internal struggle for power that has begun may be to pull his army back into Russia to protect him from his rivals. With no realistic route to military victory, could Putin settle for a political fig leaf that would disguise his defeat, asked Dan Ryder in the Los Angeles Times. Ukrainians have been adamant they will not surrender territory, and their successful counteroffensive takes that option off the table. Facing total defeat, Putin might settle for Ukraine's agreement not to join NATO. That small concession would be worth it to end this war and stop the suffering. We Ukrainians are in no mood to negotiate, said Margot Gontar in the New York Times. Putin's missile strikes sent a message, but not the one he wanted. In Putin, we now see a tired old man whose attempt to terrorize us smacks of futility and desperation. In Ukraine, there is an almost palpable feeling that Russia is losing the war, and we will keep fighting until the brutal invaders are driven from our soil. And the second main story, as referenced in the cover drawing, ignoring U.S. pleas, Saudis slash oil production. What happened? The Biden administration and senior Senate Democrats this week threatened to punish Saudi Arabia after the OPEC oil cartel defied the U.S. and said it would cut oil production. The Saudis coordinated with Russia and other oil-producing nations to reduce output by 2 million barrels a day starting next month, which will raise global oil prices and boost the Russian economy. The announcement juiced U.S. gas prices, which were already creeping up after a three-month decline, to more than $3.90 a gallon, with even higher prices likely. President Biden warned of unspecified consequences for OPEC's actions, and White House spokesman John Kirby suggested that the country should continue to reevaluate its relationship with the Saudis. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, went further, proposing the U.S. should immediately freeze all aspects of U.S.-Saudi cooperation and pledging to block weapon sales to the country. Saudi Arabia has been the lead importer of U.S. weaponry, spending billions to buy 23% of all U.S. weapons sold between 2017 and 2021. OPEC's cut was seen as a direct snub to Biden. He had once vowed to make Saudi Arabia a pariah for the murder of dissident Jamal Khashoggi. But in a July visit to the repressive kingdom, he fist-bumped Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and outright asked for an increase in oil production. U.S. officials later lobbied Gulf states to at least delay the cuts in production, warning that action now would be seen as overt support for Russia in its war against Ukraine. But Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Fasil bin Farhan insisted this week that the decision, which could drive oil prices up to $100 a barrel, was made for purely economic reasons. What the editorial said. So much for Biden's begging bowl diplomacy, said National Review. While the final cut will likely be short of 2 million barrels, the decision to slash oil production as the U.S. holds its midterm elections is still a clear rebuff to the president. The most effective solution to keep prices from skyrocketing would be to increase domestic production. But Biden has thwarted expansion efforts, suspending oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and trying to block offshore drilling. That has made it even easier for Gulf nations to inflate the price of oil. U.S. leaders must keep cool heads, said the Washington Post. They should resist restricting petroleum exports, which will just punish our trading partners. Instead, they'll have to play a long game to reduce dependence on foreign oil by taking advantage of our domestic supplies of fossil fuels and green energy and investing in energy infrastructure. A knee-jerk response now might make matters worse. What the columnist said. MBS has put a dagger into Biden's back, said Trita Parsi in MSNBC.com. Saudi Arabia's de facto leader has boosted the chances of a red wave in November with higher oil prices that could help Russia finance its war on Ukraine. A mere fist bump was not going to change the Saudi preference for Republicans, said Dov Sakim in The Hill. Riyadh had extremely close ties to the Trump administration and was offended by Democratic criticism of its role in Yemen's civil war and its 2018 killing of Khashoggi. Biden's push to revive a nuclear deal with Iran has not helped either. This is a self-inflicted crisis for Biden, said Matthew Continetti in National Review. He wanted to placate both the green crusaders who hate fossil fuels and the voters who are likely to punish Democrats for soaring gas prices. But he remains so stubbornly opposed to domestic drilling that he is reportedly exploring a possible oil deal with Nicolas Maduro's hostile regime in Venezuela. Pissed off Democrats want revenge, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. They are considering reviving NOPEC, N-O-P-E-C, a bill that would let the Justice Department file antitrust lawsuits against the oil cartel. But this is the absolute worst moment for such a provocation. The time for NOPEC would be when there's too much oil sloshing around to give the Saudis leverage over the U.S. Pushing it through at this moment of scarcity would only invite OPEC to retaliate by cutting production further, crippling Western economies. We need to give the Saudis a well-deserved slapback, just not yet. Controversy of the week is election denial. Can democracy survive? As the November midterm elections loom, the truth is plain and painful, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. If Republicans take both houses of Congress next month, it may mean the end of democracy as we know it. That may sound like partisan hyperbole, but a post-analysis last week found that of the 569 Republican candidates for congressional or key statewide offices this fall, 299, more than half, are on record supporting Donald Trump's big lie that Democrats used massive voter fraud to steal the 2020 presidential election. with 60% of these election deniers running in safe Republican districts, it is all but certain that in January, a majority of the party's congressional delegation will reject the free and fair elections that are the foundation of the American experiment. The GOP is also running election deniers for key Secretary of State posts in Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, and other major battleground states. And at least two gubernatorial candidates, Doug Mastriano of Pennsylvania and Kari Lake of Arizona, have pledged that the Republican nominee will win their state in 2024, whomever voters may prefer. It's getting harder to see how democracy can survive Republicans' lurch into fascism, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. Our last best chance is to rebuke them next month by margins so decisive they can't plausibly challenge the results. To prevent that, Republicans are planning to discourage people from voting, said the New York Times in an editorial. In their precinct strategy, Trump allies have signed up thousands of the MAGA rank and file to serve as poll workers and precinct officers. They are being trained on how to harass and challenge voters at polling places, and then to contact an army of Republican lawyers who will help in the attempt to disqualify them. There's an even bigger threat to democracy, said Stephen Donziger in The Guardian. The Supreme Court has chosen to weigh in on the independent state legislature doctrine, a crackpot theory that could lock in right-wing control of the United States for generations. If the court upholds that theory, it will give partisan majorities in state legislatures the sole, unreviewable power to change election districts and election laws, and even to disregard the popular vote in presidential elections in order to choose their preferred electors. That would put the U.S. squarely on the path to authoritarianism. There are glimmers of hope even within the GOP, said the Washington Post in an editorial. 11 Senate Republicans, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, have already signaled support for the bipartisan Electoral Count Reform Act. This legislation would clean up the archaic laws governing the selection of a new president, stitching shut many of the loopholes Trump and his cronies exploited in trying to overturn the 2020 election. It's only human to hope for the best, said Tim Alberta in The Atlantic, and millions of Americans can't quite bring themselves to face what's happening. But the mind-boggling reality is that our democracy is actively being sabotaged. If most of the election deniers now seeking power do not lose and lose badly, they will put us on a path to national calamity. The 2024 election may decide America's fate, said David Montgomery in the Washington Post, especially if Donald Trump or one of his authoritarian acolytes wins the Republican nomination. Only vigilance and civic engagement can prevent the nightmare from coming true. So, good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for endurance after Irishman Damian Brown arrived in his native Galway after rowing across the Atlantic from New York in 112 days. It's nice to be alive, said Brown, 42, who capsized three times during the 3,450-mile voyage and cannot swim. It was a good week for starting fresh after supermodel Gisele Bündchen was photographed having her SUV spiritually cleansed by a holistic practitioner waving a stick of burning sage. Bündchen reportedly is seeking a divorce from NFL legend Tom Brady. It was a good week for climate action after New Zealand proposed taxing the burps, farts, and urination of its 36 million farm cows and sheep to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But it was a bad week for bugs. with reports that the new Apple iPhone 14, which alerts 911 if it detects the user has been in a car crash, is having trouble distinguishing crashes from roller coaster rides. One emergency service director in Ohio said her county has had at least 6 coaster-triggered false alarms. It was a bad week for Zaima Johnson, 27, who applied for a job with a New Jersey law enforcement agency, despite being wanted in Pennsylvania on fraud charges and 10 missed court appointments. Johnson was arrested at her job interview. It's a bad week for Renaissance men after Elon Musk denied that he told political scientist Ian Bremmer that he'd conceived his widely mocked pro-Russia peace plan for Ukraine after speaking to Vladimir Putin. Musk later said he spoke to Putin just once, 18 months ago, and the subject matter was space. The title of the briefing this week is Battling Over Books. Conservative groups and Republican officials are campaigning to ban books from schools and libraries. Is this campaign new? Attempts to ban books have gone on for decades, but free speech advocates say the scale of the current effort is unprecedented in this country. In many states, angry parents have filled school board meetings with lists of dozens of books and demands they be purged from classroom and libraries. Most deal with racial issues, homosexuality, and gender. A report by PEN America found 2,532 instances of book banning in 32 states during the past school year. The American Library Association, the ALA, counted nearly 1,600 different books, most dealing with race and LGBTQ issues, targeted for bans or restrictions last year, the most in the 20 years they've tracked such efforts. Penn counted more than 50 groups fighting to ban books, including Moms for Liberty, which since its founding in 2020 has grown to nearly 100,000 members in 38 states. Governors, state legislatures, and local officials have joined in the effort. Where has that happened? In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has called for criminal charges against school staffers who allow children access to books deemed pornographic. Oklahoma passed a law removing protection against prosecution for teachers and librarians who distribute obscene material. In March, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a law that bans schools from using books that are pornographic or age inappropriate and expands parents' ability to challenge books used in classrooms or available in school libraries. In San Antonio, school administrators had librarians pull more than 400 titles dealing with race, sexuality, and gender off the shelves after a Republican state representative, Matt Krause, made a list of 850 objectionable titles and asked school districts to investigate whether their libraries stocked them. Ban opponents say that's part of a growing trend of soft censorship, administrators and librarians quietly removing books they fear might draw conservative scrutiny. What books are being targeted? About 40% of banned books address LGBTQ themes or have prominent LGBTQ characters, according to Penn. The most banned books include Maya Kobabe's Gender Queer, a graphic novel about a non-binary teen, and George M. Johnson's All Boys Aren't Blue, a memoir about growing up black and queer. These books include passages about masturbation, oral and anal sex, and sexual assault. Opponents say such content is inappropriate for young people and that access should be a matter of parental choice. I would like to protect my kids' hearts and minds from this, said Jennifer Adler, a mother of five in Katy, Texas, referring to It's Jack of Hearts and Other Parts by Lev A.C. Rosen, a graphically sexual book about a cross-dressing gay teen. But others say the main objections to such books as discussion of LGBTQ matters that, as Amber Cole, a bisexual student in Katy, put it, shows gay, trans, and non-binary kids that their feelings are valid and okay. Some of the most frequently targeted books have no sexual content but draw fire for their discussions of racism. How often is race the issue? One in five challenged books falls into this category, according to Penn. Books in conservative crosshairs include Ruby Bridges Goes to School, a child's book about the first black child to integrate a new school, biographies of Nelson Mandela and Duke Ellington, and How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi, one of the most banned books last year, according to the ALA, was Angie Thomas' The Hate U Give, about a black teen whose friend is shot by a police officer during a traffic stop. The list made by Kraus, the Texas state representative, targets any books that might make students feel discomfort because of their race, including William Styron's Pulitzer Prize-winning 1967 novel, The Confession of Nat Turner, and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, a critically lauded book on Coates' struggle with racism, written as a letter to his 15-year-old son. Is there pushback on the bans? Yes, and the battle over books is heating up. Last month, a House committee held a hearing where witnesses included librarians, teachers, and students. Committee Chair Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, called book bans a hallmark of authoritarian regimes. In some communities, parents and students have mobilized to fight bans. In York, Pennsylvania, a coalition successfully fought back after the school board banned numerous books dealing with racial matters, including children's books about civil rights icons Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Similar efforts have succeeded in Annandale, New Jersey, Round Rock, Texas, and Milford, Ohio. Free speech advocates say that a silent majority does not agree with censorship, and they must speak up or a loud minority will dictate what books and ideas are off limits. Now is the time to start building those communities, said Round Rock parent Natasha Daniels. You're going to need to band together to fight what is coming down. Move into a few of the best columns from the week. We will start with two from the U.S. Ukraine may split the GOP. The Republican civil war over Ukraine is coming, said Nick Cottagio. Though polls indicate that the U.S.'s $67 billion in aid to Ukraine thus far still has bipartisan support, hairline cracks within the GOP are widening. Polls indicate only a slim majority of Republicans, 51%, think the U.S. should maintain support until the Ukrainians reclaim all their territory. And 43% say the U.S. has already given Ukraine too much aid. In Congress, establishment Republican hawks are being challenged by an isolationist America First wing that punches above its weight. Representative Roger Williams of Texas, for example, contends that the military equipment being sent to Ukraine should be down at the border, repelling Venezuelans and Central Americans. Some MAGA Republicans view Vladimir Putin sympathetically as a white Christian nationalist fighting Western decadence. If Republicans take the House and or Senate, the isolationists will try to force the U.S. to curtail support. They will have an uphill fight, especially if Ukraine continues its success. In the Senate, Democrats need only about 10 Republican hawks to filibuster any attempt to cut aid. But in January, the battle over further assistance to Kyiv could begin in earnest. Do pigs deserve better? Pig farming doesn't have to be this cruel, said Mark Essig. The Supreme Court will soon hear a case in which the National Pork Producers Council is challenging California's constitutional right to set humane standards for how pigs are raised, which is likely to affect pig farming throughout the nation. In a 2018 referendum, 63% of California voters approved a proposition which effectively bans the sale of pork from farms that use gestation crates, tiny wooden pens that leave sows unable to even turn around. In modern industrial pig farms, pigs, which are intelligent social creatures, are condemned from birth to a miserable existence in these crates, with no dirt to root in, no straw bedding, no access to the outdoors, and endless pregnancy through artificial insemination. The California law will require farmers to provide sows with nearly double the amount of space they have now so they can turn around, move, and interact. Modest requirements for a sentient mammal. Most pork consumers would be horrified if they saw industrial hog farms, and if we had a chance to look pigs in the eye, we might have trouble looking ourselves in the mirror. This column comes from the Czech Republic. The joke that didn't amuse the Russians. We have met the Russians' preposterous claims on four Ukrainian territories with our own land grab, said Tobias Eich. Why not split the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad between Poland and the Czech Republic and finally give the Czechs access to the sea? The territory, a little spit of land currently wedged between Poland and Lithuania and bordering the Baltic Sea, was founded as Königsberg in 1255 in honor of Bohemian King Przemysl Otakar II. That means the Czech claim on it goes back much further than the Russian. The Soviets captured it at the end of World War II. It makes so much sense, in fact, that what started as a gag on Czech Twitter, make Kaliningrad Czech again, spread quickly to become a nationwide game. A travel agency began offering seaside tours, and Lithuania's foreign ministry announced it was a great relief to no longer share a border with Russia and said it was looking forward to our new Czech neighbors. Russians, though, actually fell for the joke and were not at all amused. Military analyst Mikhail Timoshenko immediately declared that Russia would never give up Kaliningrad, and Russian sites denounced the scheme as revanchist. Of course, by doing so, Moscow has also inadvertently indicted itself on the same charge and exposed the absurdity of its great power fantasies. Time for the last word. Title this week, Path of Destruction. Fort Myers Beach was ground zero for Hurricane Ian, said Linda Robertson in the Miami Herald. In the aftermath, rescuers searched for survivors and bodies. Fort Myers Beach, Florida. Pasco, a young black Labrador retriever on his first search and rescue mission, quickly picked up the scent on Anchorage Street. He led a Miami firefighter to the top of a rubble pile and jumped down the other side. "Confirmed," the firefighter shouted over the din of a helicopter passing overhead. "One deceased." Pasco is trained to find live humans. Other dogs are trained to find human remains. But 48 hours after Hurricane Ian attacked this mellow beach town, emergency crews were discovering more dead people than they were saving trapped people. As bright sunshine lit up the clear blue sky Friday, the firefighter grabbed a rain-soaked maroon bedspread and covered the body slumped on lumber from what used to be a bedroom or kitchen or bathroom. It was impossible to tell where in the house the victim may have tried to seek shelter when an 8 to 10 foot storm surge submerged the barrier island on Wednesday afternoon. The fighters of Squad 6, Florida Task Force 2, radioed a medical unit to pick up the fourth body they'd found on their second day of searching, tied pink plastic tape around a palm tree, and walked down the block to probe more ruins. Most of Fort Myers Beach, a town on Estero Island that swells to four times its year-round population of 5,600 during snowbird and tourist season, was razed when Ian crashed ashore packing 150-mile-per-hour winds. There were multiple eyewitness accounts of horrifying fates. "We've seen bodies everywhere," said John Galatro, who wrote out the storm in the Leonardo Arms condo. "We counted 10 people in our building who died trying to climb to the roof during the height of the surge. The water was raging and swept some away. I personally covered one with a blanket. We made deceased signs so the helicopters could see them." Galatro, his girlfriend, and his daughter were resting with a tearful woman from their condo under the roof of a hotel. They were pushing luggage carts filled with their belongings toward the Matanzas Pass Bridge to the mainland. "Everyone on this island is going to need a lot of therapy," he said. "We rescued an old couple who had to tread water for hours. We pulled them out of a flooded laundromat where they said they were holding on to whatever they could to keep afloat." Pastor Forrest Krister wept as he recounted what happened to his church and his neighbors. "We found a dead lady with her two dogs by her side. They were dead too," he said. "The paramedics found a dead couple. I'm sure more are going to turn up under all this debris and on other islands." Kritzer and his co-pastor son, Kevin Sean, said their Beach Baptist Church was totaled. Two white crosses were intact, but the interior was a mess. Also destroyed, the adjacent food pantry that provided 1,200 meals per week and a 62-bed retreat, and Kritzer's home. "My house is completely gone," he said, breaking into tears. He was wearing a T-shirt that said, "Blessed and highly caffeinated." "See these stakes and concrete slab? That's my 3-bedroom house. See that bunch of sticks down the street? That's my house. I've got nothing but the clothes I'm wearing." Yet Kritzer was most concerned about my people, his ministry for the town's homeless people. He was trying to find transportation for 36 to a shelter downtown Fort Myers. Matthew Storr saw a corpse in the wreckage of Times Square, the town's core of quaint or kitschy, depending on personal taste. Beachwear shops, bars, fried fish joints, souvenir stands, tattoo and ice cream parlors. "I'm going to have nightmares," Storr said. He worked at the Tropical Grill. His girlfriend, Mackenzie Hood, worked at the Lighthouse Resort. where they and other employees took refuge on the second floor during the storm. The storm was so nasty and the water was so high, we're lucky we survived, Hood said. It was scary. We drank a lot. Along the town's main drag, Estero Boulevard, dazed residents trudged through slippery gray muck, dragging suitcases or pushing shopping carts full of whatever they could salvage. They were making an exodus. Police closed off the island to visitors and cars and weren't sure when or if they were coming back to their slice of heaven, known for its sunsets, seashells, and rum runners. Business owners assessed the damage and debated whether to rebuild. No one ventured a guess as to when power, water, and cell service would be restored. Scattered around the apocalyptic landscape was the flotsam of their everyday lives turned upside down. Ovens, air conditioners, stairways to nowhere, beer kegs, mattresses, toilets, a Peloton, a wedding album, a lawnmower, cars with shattered windshields, lonely sandals missing their mates. All that remains of the popular pier are skeletal slats and pilings. Most stunning was the sight of houses washed inland. Like a supersized tide driven by Category 4 winds, the water ripped buildings off their foundations and carried them 50, 100, even 300 yards as they were moved around like Monopoly pieces. Picturesque old wood frame cottages were particularly vulnerable. The destructive power of the surge made this hurricane equivalent to 200 mile per hour winds, said Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, who was in Fort Myers Beach on Friday. How would Miami deal with 10 feet of storm surge? Is any city on the planet capable of dealing with it? When you consider the loss of life and the billions of dollars at stake, our priority needs to be investing in methods for blunting storm surge. The disorienting displacement complicates the job of rescuers. Addresses and maps become useless. They're not only searching for people, but remnants of the places where those people lived. The difference between flooding is that during surge, structures slam into each other, said Iggy Carroll, executive director of Miami's Fire Rescue Department, describing the bowling ball effect of storm surge. At the location where we'd expect to see a house, there is no house. We have to follow the debris path to find it. Conversely, here's a house that wasn't here before. Miami Lieutenant Peter Darley said first responders have to act as detectives when time is of the essence. We received a heads up that a neighbor was missing, fourth house down on Anchorage, but there is no house there. They told us to look for a blue roof, but there is no blue roof here. We found it on the next block, he said. We were looking for two bodies on Andre Mar Boulevard. We had to hunt for clues, the color of the paint, a house number, the make of the car that used to be in the driveway. We found them 200 yards from where the house had stood. During their first 24 hours in the area, Florida Task Force 2 members, among 1,000 rescue personnel dispatched across the state, rescued 60 people. They will transition to the next phase of their operation, which entails rigorous searches. First, we're doing a primary search of rubble and conditions, and we're looking for people who are in distress and need help, Lieutenant Jennifer Arguello said. That gives us a game plan on where to concentrate searches for human remains. We rely a lot on neighbors, friends, and relatives to track who is where. Through years of experience with disasters, including last year's Surfside condo collapse that killed 98, Task Force 2 has developed specialists in search and rescue, structural engineering, hazardous materials, medicine, and canine. They've modified vehicles to maneuver through deep water and challenging terrain. Carol was driving one of the city's jacked-up SUVs down Estero Boulevard, navigating past a growing fleet of ambulances, earth movers, and dump trucks, when he was stopped by an 84-year-old man who was trying to walk off the island but had become exhausted. Carol called a ride for him. Later, Cigar Hut owner Stephen Light flagged Carol down, and Carol drove him to his girlfriend's apartment on Lover's Key, where they were reunited. He also made sure an elderly man in a wheelchair received treatment and touched base with paramedics who rescued four immobile people from the Point Estero condo. Back with Squad 6 on Anchorage Drive, Carol, Darley, and Arguello checked on Emiliano Emmy Crespo, who was splattered with mud and wore bandages on his legs. He was relieved to see the Miami crew. "I survived Andrew, too, from Perrine," Crespo said of the 1992 hurricane that devastated South Miami-Dade County. "Half my house was destroyed and my car was found 13 blocks away. You'd think I'd have learned my lesson and evacuated." "The water's what did it this time. I didn't think the water would come that high," he said, pointing to a 9-foot-tall water line in his garage. "Andrew was a lot of wind and plain old rain. This was like a tidal wave." Brad Evans and his wife, Reggie Ann, are also complacent hurricane veterans who regretted not evacuating. Ian squatted over Southwest Florida and pounded it for hours. "It's the most frightening thing we've been through. We've done Category 5 whitewater rafting, and it was way worse than that. It looked like the inside of a washing machine," Evan said. "It came up to 8 or 9 feet very fast, peaked at 4:45 p.m., and receded within 90 minutes. We went through all the hurricanes when we lived in South Florida, and we thought 3 to 4 feet of storm surge, yeah, we can handle that. We were wrong. This is what we're going to get from now on with climate change." After their traumatic experience, Matthew Storr and Mackenzie Hood remain shaken. They have mixed feelings about leaving the beloved island. They've heard nothing about their restaurant and hotel jobs, service jobs that are the lifeblood of the local economy. Storr struggled to find the right words to describe nothingness. "It's gone. It's all gone, just gone," he said. Then he raised a fist. "We effing made it," he whooped. "We made it out alive." This story was first published in the Miami Herald. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The coal miner's daughter who rose to stardom, Loretta Lynn, 1932-2022. Loretta Lynn rose from rural poverty and teen motherhood to become one of the biggest names in country music and a groundbreaking voice for women. The coal miner's daughter, as her 1970 signature song proudly proclaimed, scored dozens of hits with plain-spoken, assertive songs that addressed the tribulations of blue-collar womanhood. The first female country star to write some of her own material, she told off a would-be homewrecker in "You Ain't Woman Enough to Take My Man," and warned a carousing husband not to expect a carnal nightcap in "Don't Come Home A-Drinking with Lovin' on Your Mind." She celebrated liberation by birth control in 1972's The Pill and demanded equality in 1979's We've Come a Long Way, Baby. "I didn't write for the men. I wrote for us women," she said in 2016, and the men loved it too. Lynn grew up in Kentucky coal country in a cabin with no plumbing or electricity, said the Nashville Tennessean. The second of eight children, she attended a one-room schoolhouse before dropping out in elementary school. At 13, she met Oliver Doolittle Lynn, a 21-year-old Army vet with a reputation for wildness. They married 2 years later, and by age 16, she was pregnant. The pair moved to Custer, Washington, where Dew did farm work and she picked berries while raising six children. Hearing her sing around the house, Dew became convinced Loretta had genuine talent. He bought her a $17 guitar and pushed her to sing in taverns. In 1960, she released a single, I'm a Honky Tonk Girl, which led to a well-received appearance on the Grand Ole Opry radio show. A deal with Decca followed. She had her first top 10 hit, Success, in 1962, and by the next year was established as a force in country music. Her popularity reached its zenith when she was portrayed by Sissy Spacek in the hit 1980 biopic Coal Miner's Daughter, said the Washington Post. After Dew died in 1996, she continued to perform and record into her 80s, and in later years racked up a string of honors, including a Presidential Medal of Freedom. She dismissed with characteristic bluntness, though, the suggestion that she'd made a singular mark on the culture. Cultural contributions? What's that? She said. I was just saying it like I was living it. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. We have an article. Hunter Biden, will he be indicted? What's the holdup in prosecuting Hunter Biden? Asked former IRS supervisory agent Martin Scheel in The Hill. The Department of Justice has been investigating President Biden's son since 2018, examining if he violated tax and lobbying laws in his lucrative business relationships with foreign countries, including Ukraine and China. He already paid $1 million in back taxes to help decrease his chance of being prosecuted. But last week, federal agents leaked to the Washington Post that they believe they have enough evidence to indict Hunter for alleged tax fraud and lying about his drug history when purchasing a gun. That decision, however, is up to David Weiss, the Trump-appointed U.S. attorney in Delaware. Attorney General Merrick Garland has said he won't interfere with Weiss, who faces a very difficult issue that will set a precedent for future cases. Can an alcoholic drug addict possess the necessary state of mind to intentionally commit tax fraud? For that reason, this case is anything but simple, said Barbara McQuaid in MSNBC.com. The DOJ has an unusually high standard. Prosecutors only indict if they are confident they can obtain and sustain a conviction and prove beyond a reasonable doubt their defendants know their conduct was illegal. This is why many tax cases are settled without criminal charges. But Weiss faces an additional requirement to treat Biden no better or worse than other offenders because he's the president's son. That puts the prosecutor in an unenviable position, and regardless of his decision, he can expect an outcry. Weiss should go ahead and indict Biden, said Jim Garrity in National Review. It will send a welcome message that no one is above the law. Sure, it will create some headaches for the president, but that will happen anyway. If Republicans win the House in November, they plan to investigate Hunter as a national security threat. Prosecuting will prove that the DOJ follows the facts and evidence without fear of favor. That might come in handy if the department ever charges President Trump with crimes, said Jack Schaefer in Politico. Garland will have already proven his commitment to the rule of law. That won't stop MAGA diehards from accusing him of bias, but swing voters would probably be persuaded. So Hunter Biden's bad news might actually be good news for Democrats. And we have time for a few of the shorter notes, starting with the U.S. national debt has topped $31 trillion for the first time, a milestone that comes amid rising interest rates that will increase the cost of carrying that debt. America's debt climbed $7.9 trillion during the Trump administration and has increased another $3.3 trillion during the first 2 years of the Biden administration. 44% of women ages 18 to 29 identify as liberal, while only 25% of men in the same age group do, according to an analysis of Gallup poll data. The share of young women who call themselves liberals has been steadily rising for about 20 years, the analysis found, creating a growing political rift between young women and men. COVID-19 vaccines prevented up to 370,000 COVID deaths and 700,000 hospitalizations last year, a new Department of Health and Human Services study found. Vaccines saved the country more than $16 billion in medical costs. On the poll watch, 60% of Democrats and 36% of Republicans say they're unlikely to blame election fraud if their party does not win control of Congress in the midterms. And we'll finish up with a quote from historian Hannah Holborn Gray, quoted in Real Clear Politics, who says, "Education should not be intended to make people comfortable. It is meant to make them think." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.